Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Webtoon Wednesday episode, and today we're going to be talking about The Fever King, which is a relatively new web strip, and I have the writer of The Fever King, Victoria Lee, joining me. Victoria, thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so I always like to ask everybody when they first come on kind of about their history with comics or all things nerdy. So let me ask you, did you grow up reading comics? Was it something you were always into?
Yeah, I always really enjoyed reading a lot of the original Marvel comics, so especially X-Men, and I definitely had a fondness for reading manga and manhwa as well when I was like in high school and college.
So at what point did you start thinking, you know what, I think I want to be an artist, I want to be a creator, maybe I'm going to make my own comic someday?
Honestly, that never occurred to me until Webtoon approached me about adapting my book into a comic, and I had not heard of Webtoon before that point, actually, but then I checked out the site, and I got completely addicted to True Beauty, among other Webtoons, and so it seemed like a really fun medium and a really, really great way to get the story out to more readers.
So you were always more on the kind of the prose side of things, had a story you wanted to tell, and figured you'd make a young adult novel. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I think you have a pretty interesting history. I was kind of reading about it. Didn't you originally go to school for something far different than you're doing now? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so kind of jumped around a little bit. I went to art school for high school and mostly studied piano and writing. And then in college, I studied psychology. And so I'm getting my PhD in psychology right now. But then I also write books. So I kind of have two careers going on at the same time.
That must be kind of tough to juggle all these different aspects.
Yeah, definitely. I basically have no free time anymore, but that's okay.
So went to like a creative high school, exercised that part of your personality, as it were. And then when you got into college, you just realized that there was something a little more cerebral that you wanted to do as well. Like how did that decision come about? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I guess. So when I was in high school, I did want to do like some form of art professionally. I wanted to be a professional writer or maybe like music professionally. But I don't know. I feel like at least where I grew up in the U.S. South, and I don't know if it was my family specifically or if it was just like the culture I was growing up in, but I didn't really feel like that was a viable option at the time. And so I, you know, went to college, and I had also kind of wanted to always be a doctor at the same time, like in the back of my head. So I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll go and do that instead, and just keep doing the arts as a hobby, but kind of made it full circle all the way back down to doing writing professionally. So I guess it is possible to do both.
Yeah, you remind me of Charles Soule. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He writes a lot of stuff for Marvel. And he's in a band on the side, and this guy's got his own law practice. I don't know when he sleeps. He's a robot, I think.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. Guy's amazing.
I know. There are a couple of other famous psychologists, like research psychologists in the field, that have other jobs. Like there was one of these professors who had like a rap career while he was in grad school, and he like toured with his like band. So I guess I'm not the first to kind of like venture outside of the academy and start doing something more creative.
Yeah, it's good to kind of exercise all the muscles of the brain, as it were.
Yeah, exactly.
So The Fever King, we mentioned that as the strip, but it was a novel first. Is this your first professionally published writing work?
Yeah, it is. So I've written a bunch of books before that, but they were mostly just, you know, like hobby writing for me. I was writing them to entertain myself, and this is the first one I tried to get published, and yeah, it worked out.
So this is going to be a little challenging. So obviously anyone who's a fan of The Fever King and has read the novelization, the original source material, you're going to know far more than those of you who are listening who are just following the Webtoon digital strip, because obviously it's just started and we haven't gone that far down the path yet. So we're going to try to limit any sort of spoilers and just talk about how far the story has gotten in terms of the Webtoon strip. But I do want you, Victoria, to kind of let our readers know sort of the broad idea of what the story is about and the world you've created in The Fever King.
Yeah, so I'd say essentially the story is about this activist kid named Num, who has always been fighting against the xenophobic anti-immigrant government of Carolinia, which is a kind of speculative, futuristic North Carolina where magic's a virus, and if you survive it, then you're able to use magic. You become something called a witching. And Carolinia, the country that Gnomes lives in, is one of the only countries in the world that supports witchings and that doesn't either exile them or, like, in some countries, kill them. So in some ways, it's in a good situation. But in another way, like, Carolinia also deports refugees from a neighboring country called Atlantia, and his parents are undocumented Atlantean refugees. And so when he gets the virus and survives and gets magic and is recruited to join this magical military training program that's funded by that same government that he hates, he kind of sees it as a chance to learn whatever he can about his magic and use it to take down Carolinia from the inside. But once he gets involved and starts learning the science behind his magic, he does try and get involved in this political coup, but he also is starting to, let's see, a non-spoiler way to put this is, I guess, get involved in political machinations that might be bigger than he fully understands at the time, and he starts to wonder who he can really trust.
So you mentioned you've had a few different stories you've written for yourself over the years, and now, you know, finally you've got something that's out there that you're sharing with the world. It's a published work. Obviously, it's planned on more than just one book. It's a series of young adult novels telling the story of this world and these characters. So what was the impetus of the idea? Like, where, obviously, when you're talking about immigration and politics and a lot of the sort of the values that are in the books and the struggles between the different ideologies, it very much mirrors kind of the real world and what's going on right now. So how much of that influenced you? Where, how long ago did you come up with the idea? How long did it take you to develop kind of that sort of thing?
So strangely, this is a little bit of a case of life imitating art, in that I wrote this book in like 2015. So pre-Trump era, there were certainly some concerns about immigration, but it wasn't really, like, the book ended up being much more similar to real life than it was anticipated or expected or planned to be. Originally, the book was inspired somewhat by Jewish history. So I'm Jewish, and this hasn't been said in the webtoon yet, but it probably will be, and it's not really a spoiler. Gnome is also Jewish, as is Calix Lehrer, the guy, the Minister of Defense, who's Gnome's mentor in the story, and Dara, his son. And so a lot of it was meant to kind of cover the intersection of intergenerational trauma, like people experienced either being the descendant of people who survived the Holocaust or pogroms, or at least being part of a group that's had that kind of history, and how that intersects with personal trauma. So when you personally survive something or experience something that's deeply damaging to you psychologically. So I was kind of trying to explore that through the book. And yeah, it's ended up becoming a little bit, unfortunately, prescient.
Yeah, you must, as the whole political campaign, presidential campaign of 2016 started unfolding and Trump taking office, you must have just been like, wait, what's going on? This is so strange.
Well, it's one of those things where you start to wonder if, like, the writing was a little bit on the wall, and if maybe unconsciously you were picking up on things that were, like, almost inevitably going to happen, given the way that the politics in the U.S. were, you know, going and moving at that point. So I don't know. But definitely, like, it was one of those weird things when the campaign started and everything ended up happening as it did, where I don't really want to say that it was, like, surprising, because I don't know that anyone who's marginalized in the U.S. found much of this surprising, so much as just, like, frustrating and scary and unexpected, or not unexpected, but, like, I don't know the word I'm looking for, but not great.
Yeah, no, I completely know what you're getting at. And the sad thing is, you know, you put it through the lens of history, right? You're talking about Noam's Jewish heritage, you know, and you're obviously right what you know, and you have that heritage yourself. And so you're drawing from, you know, growing up and your experiences living in that culture. And here we are through the lens of history looking at, you know, when the Jews were persecuted during World War II and, you know, throughout history, anti-Semitism and things. And it's like, here we go again. Have we not learned? And in a way, it's frustrating. It can cause people to be angry because it's like, how many times do we have to make the same mistake, you know, as a race, as a species, before we learn from our mistakes? And it's one of those things where I think the value in story is to hopefully teach those lessons. And so it sounds like you're bringing it into the story so you can kind of tell it in a non-threatening way, if you know what I mean. Because it's one thing to rail against somebody who has a different political ideology as you, and you're kind of bashing them over the head with your ideas, you know, yelling, and they're yelling back. And in the end, nobody really listens or has an open mind because they're too busy trying to get their point across. But when you take those same values and you put them in a story and you make it compelling and you make it entertaining, sometimes you can reach people on the other side who might not have listened otherwise. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And it's actually interesting you bring up the history repeating itself, because I think that's one of the main themes that gets drawn out in The Fever King, because Kayla Clare, you know, the Minister of Defense, his grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And then in his backstory, he survived a genocide against witching, so magic users, that took place around, like, the current day, because, you know, Fever King takes place in the future. And then now, in their modern day, there's this immigration crisis. There's the, like, repeated outbreaks of magic and the association in some people's minds between magic and the Atlantean refugees, and then the violence against them and mass deportations and funneling them into refugee camps. And so one thing that I'm kind of trying to draw out to that is both, like, how history repeats itself and how, like, people, individual people, can re-perpetuate the same violences that were performed on them, on other people. So, like, how sometimes experiencing trauma can lead you to transform that into activism, and other times other people end up, you know, becoming perpetrators themselves.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about it and talk about these ideas. And I always love to get deep into story and dissect it down. And I know not all my listeners like that. Some of them just want to be entertained. And that's totally valid. But it's interesting because, you know, we started off talking about sort of you exercising these different parts of your personality with the creative side and the more cerebral side with the psychology and such. But really, when we start getting down into the nitty gritty of The Fever King, you're really talking about using kind of both sets of those skills, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if you could give us a rundown of the main characters. You've mentioned a couple of them in passing. Maybe you could kind of let us know who we've met so far and sort of what their role is in the story.
So there's Manova, who's our main character. He is a 16-year-old Latino Jewish boy who's the child of undocumented immigrants from Atlantia. He loves computers. He loves reading. He grew up literally in a bookstore that had been transformed into tenement housing, so he has read a lot. But he spent a lot of his time volunteering at the Migrant Center with Tom Brennan, who I'll mention in a second. And he's very passionate about fighting for immigrant rights. He's also passionate about anything to do with hacking and using his hacking skills essentially for terrorism to try and, like, mess with the Carolinian government. There's also, so we meet Tom Brennan, who's not related to him, but like an uncle-like figure from them, who works at the Penguin Center. He's a close family friend. We meet Caleb Clare, who's the Minister of Defense of Carolina. He's a 123-year-old witching. He survived this terrible genocide against magic users 100 years ago that was called the Catastrophe. And he and his brother together defeated the government that had perpetuated that and created Carolina from the ashes of the former North Carolina and South Carolina. And so he's was then king until he abdicated the throne. Now he's the Minister of Defense, and he kind of becomes Noam's mentor figure. We also briefly see somebody named Dara, Dara Shirazi, who's Lair's adopted son. He is 18. He is very, very good looking and very snobby, very pretentious. He really likes to read, especially in the Bokoff books. He and Noam really, really don't get along at first, which is not a spoiler because you can tell from the panel that he's shown in at his first sighting. We also meet the other level four students. So these are the students in the magic training program with Noam. There's Carter Ames, who's Dara's best friend. She's also the daughter of the Carolinian Home Secretary. She's kind of a little bit abrasive, but she has a really good heart. She's like very, very soft inside. There's also Bethany Glennis, who's 14. She's a healer, and she and Noam get quite close. And there's also Tay. Tay is around Noam's age, so he's 16. And he has this pretty cool magical ability that has to do with math. So he's like a math genius, and he can use math to make things bigger and smaller or heavier and lighter and do all other kinds of cool tricks with that. I think that covers most of the characters that we've either met or seen.
Yeah, I think you got everybody. Yeah, definitely. Is it a challenge? Yeah. Is it a challenge to work with such a kind of a big cast? Obviously, you know, early on so far, what we've seen on the webtoon strip, we've mostly been focused on Noam. We just now are starting to introduce some of these other characters. But when you were writing the original novel, was it fun to work with such a large cast? Was it a challenge? Was it hard to find them, their voices individually? What was that like?
It was definitely a challenge. I would say that I focused most on Noam and Dara and Lair and Ames because they were the characters that had the most influence in the plot. The other ones, like, you know, they had their own personalities and their own interests and their own goals, but they weren't like really in the first book, The Fever King, which is the one that's been published so far. They weren't like super huge drivers of the plot, but they become more important in the sequel. So if the sequel ends up also getting drawn into the webtoon, then hopefully we'll see them get increasingly involved.
How many books do you have plotted out in this kind of first part of the story?
It's just two. So it's a two-book series. So I've already written the second book and edited it, and it will come out March 17th. So it's all done.
Oh, wow. Well, you really built such an interesting world here, especially because so often when writers choose to kind of write these young adult novels with these different ideas they want to explore and such, so often it's some kind of fictional world. You chose to set it in our world, but obviously in the future where a lot of things have changed. What was your thinking behind setting it in our actual reality?
So I actually originally set it like even more closely to our reality. So originally I had written it as an alternate history where everything kind of went different in the 1960s. Mm. And then it was the current day or like slightly after the current day in the books. I did end up making it more futuristic just because I didn't want the timelines to get too confusing for readers. But part of why I wanted to do it with this like semi-alternate history format is, I think, to make the comparisons between the book and people's own lives more clear. Especially because if I were to just be talking specifically about the Holocaust or about any like specific group's issues, especially ones that happened like further in the past, or like second world fantasy issues happening to like people in groups that don't exist at all, then I think it would just take like a little bit of a greater leap, especially for teen readers who are like maybe new to reading in this kind of genre, to like make these connections between like what's going on in this world and what's going on in my world, and like how can I make a difference and how can I behave differently or see things through a different lens. And I also think it was just easier to use this whole idea of history repeating itself if you can like draw a very clear linear connection from the Holocaust into like a set of fictional atrocities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's like you said, it's almost using shorthand, right? You don't have to spend a lot of time establishing the history of this fictional world if you use our actual history of our world. But then, yeah, like you said, it also makes it more grounded and more relatable at the end of the day.
Right. Like, so, I mean, I mentioned I'm a psychologist, and one, like, buzzword or, like, term that we use in psychology is called heuristics, and it essentially means, like, these mental shortcuts where if you give somebody just a little hint of something, a lot of times they can infer, like, all of this incredible nuance and detail behind it, or use, like, a little bit of information to make an inferential leap and get to, like, a larger piece of information. So sometimes just using these real-world clues can be enough to, like, just a tiny few details about them to associate heuristically to, like, a larger landscape of associations and emotions and memories and readers, so that they can create their own, like, emotional, like, tapestry around the world and upholding the world and, like, hopefully giving them a fuller and deeper and more interesting experience with the events in the book.
Yeah, I think that's especially true with your target audience. It's a young adult novel, and, you know, just purely based on their age and how long they've been alive, they don't necessarily have as many experiences to draw from. So if you can give them those shortcuts, it can definitely help them put things into context, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think, you know, teen readers are, like, super smart, and I've heard, like, some incredibly insightful and brilliant commentary and feedback from teens who have read the book and who have read the webtoon, and a lot of it does seem to stem from the connections that they're making between the things that are happening in the world and things that are happening in their own lives. And so that's always really good to see.
You know, we were talking before about kind of influencing culture and you know, having a positive impact on the world through fiction and story, and a way to sort of, you know, reach the other side, people that have different political ideas. When you set about to write a story, though, or a book, as, you know, when it's fiction, first of all, it's got to be entertaining, right? Otherwise, people are not going to spend the time to read it and hopefully, you know, enjoy it and then kind of take some of it into themselves, so to speak, in terms of thinking about it later and thinking about some of the ideas. So as a creator, when you're creating the story, whether it's writing the original prose novel or adapting it for webtoon, how much do you think about the themes you want to explore as you're laying out the story, and how much of it is, I just want to make this entertaining and good, and kind of the themes and the ideas will come out organically?
So in a lot of ways, I think I start from character first. So when planning The Fever King and planning its sequel, I had like these ideas of Noam and of Dara and of Lair and like their experiences that they'd had and how those intersected and kind of mirrored each other. I don't want to give too much away, but like as people read through the webtoon, and especially as they get to the end of the arc of what covers the first book, they'll start to see more and more the way that these three characters are all what we in literature call foils of each other. Mm-hmm. Like they're these black mirror reflections of one another. And so I think I started there, into themes for me a lot of the time emerge first from character, and then they get mirrored in the plot, because I construct the plot based off of knowing what the character is and knowing what's happened to them and what they want. What could I make happen in their world or in their lives to challenge them, or to like take away the things they want, or make it harder to get what they want? And that's how like the plot is created, is from the characters wanting something and either having it taken away or not being able to get it, and they're fighting for it.
So you mentioned wanting to be a writer for a really long time from a young age. Was that something that you knew instinctively, character first? Because I hear it from so many writers and so many writers that I really respect, is it's got to be character first. You know, it can't ever be character in service to the plot. It's got to be the other way around. It's got to be character first. You have to care about the characters in order to be invested. So how much of that was kind of your natural gift as a writer, and how much was that something you learned while you were in going to high school for the arts?
Good question. I think a lot of it was like my personal interest just being in the characters more than in the plot. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, thinking about all of the stories that I really loved, and I used to write a lot of fan fiction when I was younger, and like the things that my fan fiction's all focused around, like none of the things that I would sit and obsess about with the books that I liked or the movies that I liked or the comics that I liked had very much to do at all with the plot of them. Like, that was interesting, and that felt very contained to the book or to the movie, whereas the character felt somehow universal. Like, they felt like the strong core of whatever the story was, and that you could take them out of that story and put them in a different story and they'd still be very much the same person, and they would almost start to twist that new story around themselves. And so I don't know, I think that it was somewhat intuitive just because that was what interested me about the things that I was reading.
Well, that's good to hear. That makes for a long career for you if you decide to continue to pursue this, because it's something that a lot of people struggle with. And I noticed that, because like I said, my favorite writers, they do that instinctively, character first. And when I find some stories that don't service it as well, it's usually somebody who has taken and these days, unfortunately, it's something they have written for television or for the big screen. And they can't get funding, or they can't get anyone to pay any attention for whatever reason. And we all know how comics are sort of at the center of pop culture these days. And so they say, I'll just turn it into a comic, and then people will pay attention. And it never works. It always ends up being a terrible comic because it's not character first, and it wasn't made for that medium. So it sounds like you have completely sidestepped that. Not that I'm saying Fever King's going to end up on the big screen and the small screen. Anything's possible. But it sounds like you completely sidestepped that landmine, so kudos to you for that.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Webtoon reaching out. You mentioned you had never really considered turning this into a sequential story with artwork. What was that initial contact like, and what made you feel like Webtoon would be a good fit for the Fever King?
So I was contacted by Quinn Salsa-Spear, who's the producer for The Fever King at Webtoon, and she had read an advanced reading copy of the book and really liked it and felt like it would be a good fit for the audience at Webtoon, and then also just that it would lend itself well to both to art and also to being serialized in this way, like kind of made into episodes. And I immediately thought that sounded super cool. Just because I loved manga and I loved comics growing up. And so, like, I automatically thought that sounded awesome. And so I went straight to the Webtoon website and started reading, like, Love Advice from the Great Duke of Hell and Laura Olympus and True Beauty. And, you know, I got completely addicted. So I talked to my agents about it. And, you know, they're the business-minded ones, so they went through the whole process of deciding if this was, like, a good idea and, like, how this would look and how this would work. Well, I just sat in the corner and read Webtoons and got excited.
So coming from a more traditional sort of look and feel for comics, like, you know, like I did, you know, you read the print stuff and it's on pages and, you know, it's left to right. What were your initial impressions of the vertical scroll?
I thought it was so cool. Like, so just like shout out Sarah, who's the artist for The Fever King, for example, like scrolling through like the panels of her episodes in the vertical scroll, like it's a completely different emotional experience than like turning the page. I feel like it's so well crafted for building a sen- a feeling of suspense, because you can sort of start to see things beginning to happen, but you don't get the full picture till you scroll down further. Like, there's a bit in one of the published episodes of The Fever King where Gnome's waking up in the hospital and he has magic now, and you see, like, his heartbeat starting as he's starting to wake up, and it, like, slowly turns red, like, kind of evoking this, like, emotion, this fear, and man, it's so good. There's also one that I can't talk about yet because it hasn't posted, but, like, Sarah does something incredibly cool with the vertical scroll in an episode that's, I think it's episode 11? Yeah, episode 11, that just, like, was so emotionally evocative that I actually gasped out loud. And so I'm addicted to the vertical scroll. I think it's such a cool way of showing art and of building a sense of tension throughout a scene.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that heartbeat scene, because I specifically was going to call out Sarah for that, because, yeah, it's amazing. It gives such a sense of buildup, right? Like, you know, okay, Gnome survived and he's waking up, but it's obviously there's this sort of disconnect, right? Like, he's completely separated from the world, and he's just got the, you know, very calm, straight line. And then all of a sudden, you know, it starts to turn red, and you get the big, you know, squiggly line of the heartbeat. And it's just, it's very impactful. And I've said this to Webtoon creators before, even though these are static images, it's not a motion comic. Just the act of scrolling, you get sort of the illusion of motion, and there's a lot to be said, and you can kind of play with that as well, and it just makes such a great reading experience.
There's also a way that, like, sometimes a lot of artists will make it feel as if, like, almost cinematic. Like, yeah. There's one, this is also from episode 11, where there's almost, like, a scene shift, and it's, like, in the same episode, so it's not, like, at the beginning of a new one, but, like, the way the vertical scroll is used, again, not, like, giving anything away yet, but, like, it evokes the kind of scene shift that you might see in a movie or, like, a TV show, where, like, you're trailing off at the end of one scene, and then you almost blink, and suddenly you're in a brand new place with a brand new emotion, and, like, the incongruity of that transition is, like, in itself extremely effective. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of vertical scroll now.
Yeah, and Sarah's work is amazing. So can you talk a little bit about when you first saw her work, her coming on the project? Did you two gel right away when you started talking about adapting this story?
Yeah, when I first saw her artwork, it was, like, just the things that she is doing with color alone are phenomenal. And, like, she just has such a way of tapping into something that I think is, like, unconscious in people's minds when they're viewing art, and, like, using color to make you feel a sense of discord, or to make you feel calm or peaceful or scared or a little bit grossed out. And so when I saw her art, I already knew that she was the absolute perfect artist for this story. And then when I started talking to her, like, she's such a, like, friendly, bubbly person, and she's just, like, you can't help but smile when you're talking to her. So we definitely clicked right away, and on a personality level as well.
So how do you go about breaking down the story that you created in the novel for the Webtoon episodes? Like, do you already have it spaced out? You know exactly how much of the story from the book is going to be in each episode? And then once you have that broken down, if that's the way you did it, then how does the workflow happen once you know what's going to be in each episode?
So each episode is approximately a half chapter from the book. But in terms of, like, where each episode actually ends and the next one begins, I pretty much leave that up to Sarah's discretion, because I feel like that's almost an artistic choice in terms of, like, what she's doing with the vertical scroll and what she's doing with, like, the colors. And sometimes I think, like, it might be that where I would think a good transition point would happen story-wise wouldn't be what would work as well with, like, what she's been building toward with, like, the colors and the art. So I kind of leave that up to her.
So once she's drawn the episode, do you then go back and kind of put in the dialogue? Is that the way it goes?
No, so all the dialogue is taken directly from the book. So she puts the dialogue in as it is written in the book, and then I get the drafts, and then I read through and send back any feedback, and we kind of like iterate that way.
Oh, I got it. So really, Sarah is, I mean, it's always an equal partnership when you're talking about, you know, comics with a writer and an artist, but you guys are almost using, I don't know if you're familiar with the term, the Marvel method, where the artist has the plot, and then they're basically just, you know, here you go, create the story, and then the writer goes back through, and if there's any changes that need to be made, then you can kind of talk through at that point. Is that kind of how you guys work?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. Like, it's very much like a guided adaptation almost, where like there's the source material, which is the book, and then Sarah adapts that into the art, and then I look at it and get involved at that point.
So that must be really interesting for you to get your own story sent back to you through Sarah's eyes, you know, how she's interpreting the story with whatever her own life experience that she's bringing to it. And then on top of that, seeing visualizations of these characters and moments of the story that you created that came from you. That must be kind of surreal in a way.
Yeah, it is surreal. It's really cool. And I think one of like the most collaborative parts of this is seeing like the way that she interprets something that might not be the way that like I saw it in my head, but like this is how she saw it in her head, and like, and that's what ends up on the page. And like, that's, I don't know, like there's something really cool about like creating something synergistically that way. Like, I've talked to like some of my writer friends before about writing a book feeling like a weird form of telepathy, where you try and put down an image that's in your head or a feeling that's in your head onto the page, and then you send it out into the world, and then you hope that readers like share that, but you also hope they're viewing it through their own lens and like creating their own interpretation of it. And so you end up like building a world or building a story together, author and reader, at the same time. And it's like its own new thing for each reader. And so this feels like a visualization of that weird telepathic mind sharing process that happens when anyone reads a book.
Yeah, and which is really cool for you. I have to imagine it must be really cool for you. But then again, it probably helps. It sounds like you and Sarah share similar values and have a lot in common. So that probably helps as well. If it was somebody that was like a completely opposite person from you, first of all, you probably never would have chosen for the project because they wouldn't have gelled. But you've been like so, I don't know, dichotomous and jarring, it seems like, for you.
Yeah, no, Sarah's pretty much the perfect person for this project.
Well, I wanted to shift gears here and let's talk about the platform specifically. It sounds like you've had a really cool experience with the Webtoon platform and the people that work behind the scenes. Would you say that's the case?
Yes, absolutely. It's been phenomenal.
Would you ever consider writing a story that specifically is for Webtoon?
Yeah, I actually definitely would. I would want to like see this one through and make sure that I was really familiar with the platform and with the expectations of the readers, but I would love to write something that was specifically for Webtoon. I'm a terrible artist, so I could never actually draw it. I would have to like collaborate with somebody. But I love this way of telling stories. I think that it's super effective and super evocative and kind of taps into a different part of the creative mind than like reading a book or watching a movie. So yeah, I would definitely.
And have you had a lot of fans of the novel who weren't familiar with Webtoon come over and have been enjoying the strip so far? Have any of them let you know that?
Yeah, I have. I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I've had a lot of readers on Twitter tell me that they'd never heard of Webtoon, or they'd heard of it, but they'd never read anything on it, and now they're making an account, so you go read Fever King. And I've also had a lot of people tell me that they bought the book because they read it on Webtoon and loved it and wanted to know what happened next. Or just, even if they didn't buy the book, they like found me on Twitter or on Instagram because they love the Webtoon so much. So it feels like a merging of communities in a way, which is super fun.
So it sounds like the strip has already found a pretty good audience, even though I think we're, what, like 7 or 8 episodes in?
Yeah, I think, yeah, we just posted episode 7 and then like 8 through 10 on FastPass.
Awesome. So what's been the biggest surprise for you in this whole process of putting it on Webtoon, working with Sarah, seeing your story, you know, sort of come to life with actual visuals here?
The biggest surprise, I think, has actually been how incredible the Webtoon reader community is. Like, everyone, I haven't read, like, every comment because that would take forever. There's, like 900 comments on some of these episodes. But, like, I've read some of them. I read, like, the top comments. Sorry, my dog is barking. Like, everyone, I don't know, I just love, like, the energy there, and I love how nice everybody is. I don't know. It was surprising that everyone was, like, so nice and, like, invested and interested and wanted to know what happened next, and that there were so many of them.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm not that familiar with how, when you write a novel, you're in the literary world, like, how do you get interactions with your readers and your fans? Like, I know in, for example, in, I guess if you do like a book signing or something, but, you know, coming from the comic book world, I know a lot of creators, they do conventions, they do shows, right? And that's their chance to sort of meet their fans and kind of gauge reaction on their work and how they're doing. And then with Webtoon, what I'm finding is it's almost every creator I've talked to just loves the fact that there's like this instant feedback with the comments and they can interact and ask questions. And yeah, many of them don't have, they either have time to create the content or they have time to read every single comment, but not both. So you're not alone. But a lot of creators have told me it's one of their favorite things about Webtoon. It's kind of this instant, you know, reaction and this instant feedback into their work. So, what is, obviously that's a big difference from the literary world, but what is the normal sort of how you get feedback when you write a book or you write a novel or other than book signings?
Well, so I will say that the Webtoon method of like this instant feedback reminds me a lot of back when I wrote fan fiction, because, you know, you throw something up on Archive of Our Own and everyone would comment and you get that instant feedback. So that's super fun and like familiar and nostalgic in that way. But with an actual book, like the published version of The Fever King, people do post reviews online, like on Amazon or Goodreads. I try not to read those because I feel like reviews are for other readers and not really meant for my eyes. So most of my interaction with readers comes on social media. So like Twitter and Instagram for the most part, but I also have a Tumblr. And then I do go to like the Comic Cons and some of the book festivals. So I was at like Emerald City Comic Con earlier this year, and I might be going to New York Comic Con in October. And then, yeah, so you do like find ways to go to these conventions and meet people there. And of course, signings. So there's lots of different ways. I would say I spend most of my reader interaction time on social media, particularly like Twitter and Instagram.
But even, I guess in that way, social media is pretty instantaneous, but I suppose it's not quite the same as dropping a new episode where everybody wants to, you know, comment and be, you know, the first. And it's sort of, as soon as it drops, you immediately have a ton of comments.
Well, and like people usually like want to read the entire book before they say anything.
Right.
So people read at different speeds. So it's like somebody reads a book and it takes them like a few days or a few weeks, and then they say something, so it gets more spread out, and then like new people will discover the book, even like it might have been out for 7 months and then somebody discovers it for the first time. Or you'll have people who've read it but like they're still talking to you because they're excited about the next book. So it's a very different experience, but it's not like instant feedback, and it's certainly not like I just read chapter 3 and here are my thoughts.
Yeah, I guess that's true, because they're getting the story in a smaller chunk, so it's almost like concentrated or curated comments for you. As okay, maybe this one story beat or this, you know, one plot thread didn't resonate, and you know, I can file that away for the next story I write. As opposed to when somebody does write a review, once they've read the whole thing, obviously it's much more broad.
Right, exactly. So like comments on a Webtoon episode are usually like, they're very specific reactions to something that happened in that episode. Whereas like on the book, usually when people contact me to say something, it's like, I love Dara. Like, is Dara gonna like play a big role in the second book? Or like, you know, oh my God, like the ending, like what's going to happen? So like much bigger picture comment.
Now, when you got approached by Webtoon and it came time to adapt the strip, obviously Sarah's doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but I wonder, did you get a chance to interact at all with sort of the Webtoon creator community? Because as great as the fan community is, I think the creator community is as good, if not better. And once you're in that fraternity of Webtoon creators, you're just like part of one big family.
No, not really, because I don't even know where I would meet them. I know that like a couple of them have followed me on Twitter and I followed them back, but I don't know like if I should DM them. Like, it's always a little scary to like slide into somebody's DMs like, hey, you write Webtoons, I write Webtoons. So I don't know if there's like a forum somewhere where everyone hangs out or what.
All right, so you hear that. I know there's Webtoon creators that listen to this podcast, so you guys need to reach out to Victoria and welcome her to the family officially. And if you do go to,
yeah, I'm shy.
If you do go to New York Comic Con, I should be there, Victoria. I'd be happy. I know there's going to be other Webtoon creators there as well, so I'd be happy to make that introduction for you, because yeah, you're part of the family. You definitely need to make some introductions, and when the time comes, because it sounds like you are interested, when the time comes to create original content for specifically for Webtoon, I'm sure there's a lot of Webtoon creators out there who'd love to help you out with that.
Yeah, that would be awesome. So yeah, hopefully I'll run into you there.
Yeah, I'm 90% sure that I'm going to be there. Just one of my coworkers is having a baby like a few weeks before that. So it just matters on timing, that kind of thing. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm like getting pitched for some panels there. So it's going to be a matter of like, do the panels get accepted? But then also like, I'm in grad school, so I have to teach and I don't know my teaching schedule yet. So like, yeah. If I had to teach on Thursday, then like I won't be able to go for Thursday, for example.
Yeah. Oh, real life getting in the way of our fun time.
I know. I know. Why can't it just be like Webtoon and books all the time?
Exactly. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Victoria. I know you're busy, but I really want to thank you for joining me. And I'll give you this opportunity. If there's anything you want to share with your fans, your listeners, anything you want them to know, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I guess I would just say, like, thank you so much for being so amazing and so welcoming of me and of the Fever King, especially as somebody brand new to Webtoon. It's been so cool to get to know and to feel like I'm part of the community. And if you want to reach me on social media, I'm on Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram, all at SoSaidVictoria.
All right, great. And I'll put a link to Victoria's social media in the show notes, everybody. So if you're having a hard time finding her, you can go click there and follow her. So again, Victoria, it was a real pleasure. I can't wait to read more of the story of Fever King. I do plan on buying the novel, but I'm going to hold off until I get the Webtoon because I don't want it to be spoiled for me. But hopefully I'll see you in New York.
Yeah, fair enough.
Have a
yeah, definitely. Thank you so much
for you to sign. So again, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.